Policy Matters is produced by Aegon and Transamerica's Global Government and Policy Affairs team. We're based in Washington, D.C., as well as The Hague in the Netherlands.
Hello, and welcome back to Policy Matters, the podcast that examines the connection of Aegon and Transamerica's business strategy with public policy issues at the state, federal, and international levels. My name is Maurice Perkins, head of Aegon's Global Government and Policy Affairs team. In this episode, my colleague Sean Cassidy is going to speak with Tom Wald, Chief Investment Officer for Transamerica Asset Management. Tom is based in Denver, and he and his team have always been integral partners and colleagues for our government affairs team as we work together to help decipher and try to unwind government regulations or policies of possible impact to our asset management clients and customers. Tom also runs his own podcast on behalf of Transamerica Asset Management, and it's called Market Pulse, which offers some healthy and candid advice on market developments, and his podcast, honestly, has served as a great guide for our own team. With that, hope you enjoyed today's conversation between Sean and Tom, and thanks for listening.
Thank you, Maurice. Tom, thank you for joining me today on Policy Matters. I'm a big fan of your Market Pulse podcast, and I've really been looking forward to our conversation about the potential market impact of some provisions that may be included in either the bipartisan infrastructure proposal or any budget reconciliation proposal that is likely to follow. Before I get to my questions, let me quickly set the stage for our listeners who may not be following the president's infrastructure proposal quite as closely as we have. In a nutshell, the president has proposed a multi-trillion dollar infrastructure proposal that includes investments in both hard and soft assets. A bipartisan group of senators countered with a smaller infrastructure proposal that the president has tentatively endorsed, but has simultaneously endorsed the idea of a budget reconciliation bill that House and Senate Democrats may use to pass the remaining parts of his infrastructure proposal and other policy priorities that are not included in the budget in the bipartisan proposal. And just for our listeners, a reminder that the reconciliation bill would require only 51 votes to pass the Senate, not the 60 needed to overcome a filibuster. So besides talking about spending trillions of dollars, one or both of these proposals may include tax changes to raise new federal tax revenue to partially offset their projected costs. And that's what we're going to talk about today. So with all that as background, Tom, do you think the market is prepared at a high level for operating in a higher tax environment if tax provisions are included in one or both of these proposals?
Well, hello, Sean, and thanks very much for having me on today. I think there's no question that the market should be prepared for some form of a higher tax environment. However, what the market should be prepared for and what they wind up actually being prepared for can often be two very different things. I think going all the way back to last year's presidential election, the Biden campaign had been very transparent at a relatively early point in the general matchup that they supported a lot of the higher tax provisions that are now front and center in this discussion. Of course, we didn't know back then that they would necessarily be linked to specific infrastructure spending legislation, and perhaps that changes the calculus somewhat. But pretty much everything that looks like it could be part of reconciliation, the increase in the marginal corporate tax rate, the increase in the top individual rate, a minimum rate on corporate book income, increase in the capital gains rate, and the elimination of the step up in basis treatment on inherited assets at certain thresholds. All of those were known and believed to be very much on the table in some form or another at the time of President Biden's election last November. So one would think the prospect of them becoming reality in whole or in part would currently be discounted in current asset prices as we speak. However, Sean, sort of the reality of the situation, in my opinion, is, as we know, stocks have had a very strong run since March of last year. The S&P 500 is up more than 90% on a total return basis. And this has been driven by mostly very good news. The vaccines have taken the rate of COVID infections down and the recovery rates up. The world is reopening, and by the end of this year, it looks like we will fully complete a V-shaped recovery in terms of both the economy and corporate earnings. And we still have close to a zero short-term interest rate environment. All of this has been good news for stocks. So the question is, let's say a couple or a few trillion dollars of infrastructure spending passes through reconciliation with all or most of these higher tax provisions directly linked to the funding, I think at that point, we would have to remember that widespread tax increases of this magnitude is something the markets have not seen since the 1990s, if not longer. And therefore, it might be naive to think the market wouldn't have some sort of adverse reaction if and when it actually goes into effect and starts to show up in realized numbers. Of course, longer term, that adverse reaction, if there were to be one, would have to be taken into account along with everything else going on in the markets I just mentioned, most of which, in our opinion, are still quite favorable for investors.
So, Tom, you've obviously been giving this a lot of thought. Thank you. Let's try to unpack that. You mentioned a lot of specific issues there. I'd like to start with the possibility of the idea of raising the corporate tax rate from the current 21% up to perhaps 25% or even 28%. And the idea behind this, of course, would be House and Senate Democrats trying to raise new federal tax revenue to pay for all or more likely a portion of any infrastructure or reconciliation. What's your reaction to that? How likely do you think that is to happen, and what do you think the market thinks of that idea?
Yeah, well, I don't think the market would have a great reaction to that by any means, to be honest. And I'm speaking purely from an investor's point of view on this. The reason I say that is that the impact is fairly identifiable. A higher corporate tax rate means lower net income and lower earnings per share for most companies. And again, Sean, this is assuming those famous four words, all else being equal. But lower earnings per share, of course, more times than not means lower stock prices. So it's a bit like asking stockholders, would you rather have a chunk of your stock's profitability stay with the company and in the stock, or go to the IRS? And most investors would probably take the former of those two choices. Now, of course, the relationship between corporate tax rates and stock prices is not quite as simplistic as I may have just laid out in big picture terms. There are a lot of other factors going on right now. And currently, Sean, corporate earnings are looking at potentially stellar growth rates as we finish up 2021 and move into next year. In fact, Sean, the latest set of estimates that's gathered by FactSet Earnings Insight are calling for S&P 500 operating earnings growth of about 35% in this calendar year 2021 versus calendar year 2020, which would also be about 16% growth from the pre-pandemic 2019 S&P 500 operating earnings. So one might say, if there ever was a year to increase the marginal corporate tax rate, this one might be it. I think you also have to look at the longer term trend in the corporate rate and put that into some sort of a historical perspective. Remember, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017 took the marginal corporate rate down from 35% to its current rate of 21%, which incidentally is now the lowest it's been since before World War II. So it wasn't that long ago that the marginal rate for companies was still about 7% higher in absolute terms than the top end of where we could potentially move in this pending legislation. Also, if you go back into past eras, the corporate rate has been a lot higher. In fact, for more than 35 years, from the 1950s through 1980s, the marginal corporate rate was anchored right at about 50%, and only came down to sub 40% after the 1986 Tax Reform Act, and bounced around in the 35 to 40% range until the Trump tax cuts of 4 years ago. Now, to be fair, in that comparison, Sean, there was a lot more favorable tax treatment for corporations in those days of these higher corporate rates that helped create a lower effective rate than the marginal rate. But I think the broader point here is that stocks have done very well over the past three quarters of a century or so with noticeably higher corporate rates than we would be looking at even after this potential increase. So would the market like an increase to 25% or 28%? I don't think so. But could it absorb that change and continue to move higher? I think to that, the answer to that question is yes, it could, and it probably will, particularly if it winds up being closer to 25% than 28%.
Thank you, Tom. That's excellent information. I should be clear, for the record, that the increase in the corporate rate is not a foregone conclusion. That is one issue that is being hotly debated within and among Senate Republicans and Democrats. But it certainly is an idea out there that we'll be following. You mentioned another issue in your opening remarks, and that is the possibility of increasing the capital gains rate. How might that impact overall investment?
Yeah, Sean. So this is another provision where the initial numbers on the expected proposed legislation perhaps look a bit more daunting than they might ultimately turn out to be. The current maximum long-term capital gains rate on assets held more than 1 year is now at 20%, which is a good bit lower than the current maximum individual tax rate of 37%. It's expected that the legislation perhaps heading for reconciliation could take this rate all the way up to the individual tax rate, which would also be adjusted as part of the legislation or to some extent is expected to be, to a top bracket of 39.6%. So when you add in a 3.8% surtax on both sides, it could conceivably take the maximum capital gains rate from 23.8% to 43.4%, which would be the highest capital gains rate the U.S. has seen since the early 1920s. So when you look at that type of an increase, it's hard to think the markets wouldn't have some major problems with a capital gains tax hike of this magnitude. And of course, aside from the impact to investors per se, there is the ongoing question as to whether or not a change of this magnitude will create an overriding disincentive to own stocks and or invest in longer term assets. However, when you peel back the onion a bit here, it may not be nearly as impacting as it appears on first blush. I say this for a couple of reasons, Sean. The first is that it's expected to be proposed, this capital gains rate increase would only pertain to those with total incomes or realizing capital gains in excess of $1 million. So everyone below that level, at least as it's been proposed to date, will not be subject to this type of increase when selling assets at a profit. Second, we are in a different world of stock ownership today than we were in previous generations, in that the majority of equities owned on a national basis are held in tax-deferred retirement plans, such as 401ks or other tax-advantaged accounts, where holdings are not going to be subject to capital gains treatment if they are sold prior to their withdrawal from those types of accounts. So when you combine these two mitigating factors, in my opinion, you can see how the widespread implications of this particular cap gains proposal are not likely to be as imposing as the initial numbers might suggest. Now, obviously, the market won't be doing any backflips in celebration of all this, but as it appears to be structured right now, I think the capital gains tax increase is probably manageable and not enough to hold back some of the more favorable market catalysts that I mentioned earlier.
That's great. And thank you for pointing out that nuance, that it's not an across-the-board rate. It's going to impact different investors and different demographics differently. That's really important.
That's right.
I don't think that's gotten the sort of attention in the news reports that maybe it should. Well, so we've talked about sort of the two headline issues, the potential increase in the corporate rate and the potential increase in the capital gains rate. But are there any other potential new tax provisions in the mix you think maybe we should be paying more attention to in terms of their impact on markets and investors and how the market might react?
Yes, that's a great question, Sean. I think if there's one provision sort of flying under the radar in comparison to some of the others, it's the elimination of the step-up in basis on inherited assets for gains on inheritance in excess of $1 million. So this gets a little complicated to summarize, but I'll give it my best shot here, Sean. Under the current tax law, when someone inherits assets following another person's death, the person inheriting the asset receives a cost basis for future capital gains as of the date of death. So, for example, over the past 30 years, the S&P 500 has averaged an annual price return before dividends of just over 8%. So, Sean, if someone bought $100,000 of stock back in 1991, 30 years ago, and held it all this time and earned an index type return on that initial $100,000, that is now worth about $1.1 million. So as the tax law stands today, if that person passes away, their heir, and let's say for purposes of this case, you know, that would be their daughter or their son, they would receive a cost basis of $1.1 million on that stock, meaning they could sell it right away and pay no taxes. Under this new provision, it would be very different. That daughter or that son would owe taxes on the capital gains as if the parent was still alive and had realized the gain. So going back to our example from a moment ago, they would owe 43% on the difference between $1.1 million and that $100,000, or about $430,000. That's quite a difference. And they would owe it at the time of their parents' death. So if you think about this for a minute, all of the aging baby boomers who might have large unrealized capital gains from being good buy and hold investors all these years, and this doesn't just include stocks, but all assets and all properties, over the course of the next couple of decades, there could be a whole lot less in wealth and asset transfers between generations than perhaps everyone had been assuming up until now. So maybe this isn't something that rocks the financial world right away, but over the course of time, I think it could have some very real reverberations. And Sean, just in practical and logistical terms, imagine the time, stress, and strain of having to go back in time and find the financial records with the historical cost basis of your parents or whomever's original asset purchases from 20, 30, 40 years ago in order to pay the right amount of taxes that are due immediately after they have passed away. I mean, this could get really cumbersome, painstaking, and messy for a lot of people. So if I had to pick one tax provision as perhaps being the one most worthy, in my opinion, of perhaps being rethought or potentially taken out of the mix, I would say it would be this one, the elimination to step up in basis on inherited assets. And we just don't seem to be hearing as much talk about that one as we are some of the others.
That's a really interesting point, Tom. We are hearing about it within the DC, sort of within the Beltway community, but I agree with you. It has not made its way sort of into the popular press, into the popular conversation. Perhaps we could do another podcast episode in the future drilling in specifically on that issue. Unfortunately, our time has kind of come to an end today, and I want to thank you for joining us on Policy Matters and sharing your insights. The policy issues we discussed with you today are exactly the type of issues that could have significant market impacts and exactly the types of issues we want to share with our listeners. I hope we can touch base again with you soon to continue our conversation once the contents of the infrastructure bill and or the reconciliation package have been finalized. Until then, I want to thank you for your participation. I want to thank our Policy Matters podcast listeners, and I want to encourage everyone to check out Tom's Market Pulse podcast. It's a great listen. Thank you.
Investments are subject to market risk, including the loss of principal. Asset classes or investment strategies described may not be suitable for all investors. Past performance does not guarantee future results. Neither Transamerica nor its agents or representatives may provide tax or legal advice. Anyone to whom this material is promoted, marketed, or recommended should consult with and rely on their own independent tax and legal professionals regarding their particular situation and the concepts presented herein. The information does not take into account any investor's investment objectives, particular needs, or financial situation. The value of any investment may fluctuate. This information has been developed by Transamerica Asset Management Incorporated and may incorporate third-party data, text, images, and other content to be deemed reliable. Transamerica Asset Management Incorporated is an SEC registered investment advisor. The funds advised and sponsored by Transamerica Asset Management Incorporated include Transamerica Funds, Transamerica Series Trust, and Delta Shares Exchange Traded Funds. Transamerica Asset Management Incorporated is an indirect, wholly owned subsidiary of Aegon NV, an international life insurance, pension, and asset management company. 1801 California Street, Suite 5200, Denver, Colorado, 80202, USA.